And the answer is that there already is that language, and it's with the indigenous people. They've been speaking it forever. And the way I discovered that was there was a coal port terminal in Bellingham, and the Lummi stepped up to oppose it, and I began to hear a whole new way of talking about these things, and it was a sacred way, and it had a certain pattern and a certain way. But by the time they were done with you, you were changed inside, you know. So I'm gonna read a little bit about that. The Lummi were pretty quiet at first about this coal port terminal. And it was looking pretty bad. The weekly there in Bellingham had actually started out kind of in thinking that this was just a done deal. There would be no way to stop it. But then one day the Lummi organized at the beach. So the beach where they wanted to develop this giant coal port was called on our maps Cherry Point. But they had their own name for it, Shwechiyashin. And they held this gathering for the public and for themselves to kind of let the community know their feelings about the proposal. Speaking first in his ancestral language, Hereditary Chief Bill James addressed the 200 or so of us, native and non-native, in attendance. I noticed as he spoke, his hands kept hovering near his heart. Then they would motion to the hills behind us, then back to his heart, out towards the sea, then back to his heart again, to the Lummi youth present, then back to his heart. Then he repeated what he said in English. When his hands were motioning to the hills, he was reminding us that they held the spirits and graves of their ancestors. When his hands swept over the sea and islands behind him, he recounted the thousands of years the Lummi had camped and fished on this beach, and how essential it was, motioning to his heart, not only for his people's physical survival, but spiritual survival. When his hands gestured toward the Lummi youth, he was affirming his people's sacred obligations to coming generations. He was redefining the place, reorienting us from the vague notions we had of a place on a map called Cherry Point, to the sacred land under our feet called Shwechiyashin, a place full of story and relationship and meaning. Earlier, before he started speaking, I noticed a group of Lummi youth starting a fire on the beach. As Cliff Colty, chair of the Lummi Business Council, reiterated the tribe's commitment to future generations, these young people were called forward, lined up to face us and draped with ceremonial blankets. A large mock-up of a check was brought forward, representing the usual bribes corporations offer tribes to forsake their tribal lands. On the amount line was written, "Not even millions of dollars," with non-negotiable stamped over it in dripping blood-red letters. Then the check was handed over to the Lummi youths, who took it over to the fire they had started earlier. As our elders stood in a solemn line with the sea and islands behind them, the youth placed the check on the fire, where it smoldered, crumpled, and curled into flame. Rising in the column of smoke went any lingering doubts about Lummi's resolve to protect their sacred lands. And that's when everything changed. You know, the whole mood in the community just suddenly galvanized. And it was a very powerful political resistance and operation. The thing eventually was defeated. So I really think, you know, we really need to make space for indigenous voices, and we need to try to learn from them. But that's also tricky because you can get into the situation of cultural appropriation, you know, and Native Americans are really sensitive when white people come up and try to act like them or you know, appropriate their language, their ways. You know, the whole kind of hippie, new agey thing is really not cool for indigenous people. So that's you know, another reason why I kind of look to the poets, you know, because indigenous people can bring a lot, but we can't just go copy the language. We have to find it in our own traditions. We have to find it in Emerson. We have to find it in just different ways of speaking. Here's another one. This is Gerard D. Nerval, 1854. The substance of creation cannot be separated from a word. Do not force it to labor in some low phrase. So, yeah, so it's hard to let go of the word environment. I think about it a lot myself, and I find myself using it. And I'm like, okay, well, here I am using it. You know, language makes things easier for us. That's part of one of those things. But, you know, one differentiation I think we can make with the word environment is that as a subject, it fails. The environment cannot speak for nature. It can't speak for the universe. It can't speak for the mystery of fractals. It can't speak for the stars. You know, what it really is, it's a political construct. But as a modifier, environmental, it can save you a lot of words. So that's kind of how I deal with that conundrum, is just, I do use the word environmental because it can speed a sentence along, but I really try hard not to just refer to this thing, the environment. And I remember once I was doing some phone canvassing. This is about 12 years ago. There was an effort to create this kind of eminent domain. I don't know. It was I-93, and the idea was to make it impossible to oppose development and things like that on a legal basis, because that would be, they would call that a taking. So any kind of environmental regulation would be reinterpreted legally as a taking. And this was kind of a right-wing initiative in the state, and I was canvassing on that. And I had a script, and the script said, you know, we're trying to protect the environment. And I started changing that around. I started saying, you know, we're trying to protect our local streams and the farms outside of town. And that little change alone changed the reception I got on the other end. So, you know, some of it is just being more specific, you know, and talking about the actual creatures themselves. I'm going to read a poem about polar bears. And the reason is because something kind of strange has happened with a polar bear, besides the fact that it's going extinct. It's become a symbol not only of climate change, but of white privilege, at least in the movement. I've seen this, and I've had people, I've sat down and talked to people, and they've looked at me and said, I don't care about the polar bear. That's just a white privilege thing. Seriously, I've had people tell me. Now, it's not the polar bear's fault that perhaps the symbol of the polar bear was overused, you know, by some of the big, you know, whitey enviros. Okay, yeah, that happens. But the polar bear should not be penalized for our political stuff. So I feel a need to speak to the polar bear when I can. This is a poem about the polar bear. It's called The Promise. The helicopter swings out, banking over the pack ice, as the biologist points his lens down at the white bear looking up from a swamp of softening ice. A dart will be fired, her vitals checked. Teeth, gums, eyes, body fat, paws, claws, her belly will be palpitated to detect if a small one is in there. That too will become data. Data will be uploaded. We'll struggle with numbers to say what it actually says. Section 2, Part 3A, she is starving. Chart 7, she is a living ghost. Documents will be sent, policies informed, and finally she will be slipped into a file with all the other living ghosts. There are places we don't mention her now. Boardrooms, of course, golf greens, government chambers, but also cafeterias, bowling alleys, construction sites, churches, dining rooms. Meanwhile, born to the white refinery of ice and snow, she goes on doing the only thing she knows, keeping to perfection her half of the promise, while the other half melts around her. It's not looking good for the polar bear. So, I'm going to move to chapter 3. You can't just depend on language. You know, there has to be action to go with the language. So part 3 of this book is about activism. And a lot of the poems were written during the Shell Null actions. Do people remember that? When that giant, and all the Kai activists, well, I got involved in that. And a lot of poems came out of that and an essay called Vigil Down. Let me just read a poem, and then I'll move to the essay. So one day, we decided to block Terminal 5, which was working on the Polar Pioneer, that big rig. And the whole strategy was to prevent the rigs from leaving port and getting up to the Arctic, because they only had like a 2-month window to do their work before the Arctic would begin to freeze over again. So we felt if we could hold them back, we had a reasonable chance of stopping them. So that was the reason to blockade Terminal 5, was to keep them from working on the rigs. So I went to a training beforehand where we, you know, practiced getting harassed by cops and how to deal with, you know, pepper spray and all that kind of stuff. At the terminal. At Terminal 5, Port of Seattle, blockading the loading of the shell vessel Polar Pioneer. We were trained to lock arms and be pepper sprayed. Instead, we're dancing. We came to shut down Mammon for a day. Along the way, we make some pavements shake and the clouds bend to listen. What is power? Where does it begin? A root is buckling the concrete. Look at the tiny white flower, called the shepherd's purse, rising out of the dark crevice. Look at how the earth breathes, and tell me what is power. We come to bring the singer in the sun, to melt the iron heart, to silence the chattering dollar. Drill rigs slam their iron needles down, executives click wingtips up marble steps, profit feeds on loss and slowly eats the world. But today we hold the road. For a day's worth of sun, we confound the motions of greed. What is power? Where does it begin? Look at the root buckling the sun-struck pavement. Look at the green shoot rising in the rupture. How tiny yet fierce that particular kind of flame. And remember, at the center of earth is fire. Attending one of these things can make you feel that way. We did shut it down for a day, and it was great. It was glorious. I'm going to read another one from this section. Amor Vincit. So Love Wins was a big banner that was floating over the barge that kind of was the central organizing place for the Kai activism. And Amor Vincit is Latin for love wins. Who's to say the trees, their roots, don't love their way rivering down into the deep breathing silence of mineral, darkness, water? Or that the branching of their limbs isn't simply their way of adoring the sun? Who's to say the heron poised hours in the shallows doesn't love the absences of meaning, logic, progress, that it doesn't praise with all its coiled being the silver sliver sliding seaward at the moment of strike? And if we fail, loving only ourselves into final ruin, who's to say what follows? Strange blooms and acid seas, new risings into scorched atmosphere, isn't love persisting? That gravity isn't really a kind of desire, and all bodies actually call to each other. That love not only wins, it can't lose. It's how the universe moves.